Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll hear from a leader in the Black Lives Matter movement who says protests around the death of George Floyd and others at the hands of police have brought the attention the advocates have been looking for. She also talks about what needs to happen next. There is plenty of information online regarding the civil unrest that's been taking place. A lot of it is incorrect. Is it misinformation or disinformation?
Misinformation may just be I just got it wrong, or I heard something but I didn't get it right. Disinformation, and that's largely what this is meant to mislead you.
We'll hear from a communications expert. That's some of what we have ahead on Statewide. Statewide is brought to you by AARP Illinois, providing information that can help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll hear from some members of the Illinois General Assembly's Black Caucus and get their take on this week's protests and what they say needs to happen now. We'll also talk with a communications expert about false information that's been spread online. We've seen plenty of examples this past week. Those stories and more still to come. We start off this week in Springfield, which is like many other cities in Illinois across the country that have hosted protest events. Some of those events were organized by Black Lives Matter Springfield. The president, Sunshine Clemens, helped found the chapter several years ago. She tells our Olivia Mitchell it's been an uphill climb to get the message through.
It's been a very slow progress, but more people are open to listening to what we're trying to say and receptive of it versus just, you know, being staunchly opposed and assuming that when we say Black Lives Matter, we're trying to devalue their lives or say that our lives matter more than them. I think a couple of years ago, Black Lives Matter was a little bit newer. People worked very hard to tie it to the negative news of just the looting and the rioting. And so people had a negative connotation with it, thinking that we were just, you know, going to be tearing up everything. Because I remember when we first were announcing that we were starting a chapter here, one of our local radio DJs, their first comment on air was, well, here come the riots. And that was just the idea that it put in people's heads. And I think people have, over time, since realized that that's not what we're about.
And in your opinion, what are race relations like here in the capital city?
They're not really talked about on a large scale, in my opinion. I know that they're very uncomfortable conversations and it's hard to deal with, but they're... In my opinion, they're talked about on small scales. There might be certain groups or an organization might be willing to talk about it with certain groups, but it's not something that's across the board. You can ask most people in town, and you know they will tell you that Springfield is very segregated. It's a diverse population, but you know it's almost like the individual congregate areas tend to stick within themselves, and because it's almost like it's a bad thing to say this is something that we need to work on, when really we should be open to that because that's how we get better.
We are in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic. This week you planned a car processional in Springfield to give people an opportunity to have their voices heard while still respecting social distancing guidelines. Are you concerned about COVID-19 spreading at the rallies?
I mean, it's absolutely a concern. That was the main motivation. If it wasn't a concern, we would have probably done a traditional, you know, shoulder-to-shoulder style rally or march. But we also knew that those type of marches and rallies were going to be happening, and we wanted to offer an alternative. If you are comfortable, you know, being out there shoulder-to-shoulder with your allies, then that you have that option out there. But if you're not, we wanted to present something else. Everybody, I think, knows that the Black community has been hit the hardest by coronavirus, and we personally were not comfortable with asking that community to come out and put themselves at risk just to use their voice.
Staying on the same topic of COVID-19, Black and Latino mm-hmm. residents in Chicago are dying from the virus at a higher rate than white residents. How is the disproportionate effect of the virus on communities of color connected to the message of these protests, or do you feel like they may be separate issues, possibly?
Well, I feel like they're connected because the message of the rallies and things that we're having is that we need to break down racism, and it's not just about police brutality. There's racism in, you know, just about every facet of this country, and that's what needs to be broken down so that we can have real change. And the reason that the Black and Latino communities are affected so much by this stems from racism, so they are connected. Because, you know, the Black and brown communities are the ones that generally have the most underfunded schools. So you go to an underfunded school, that's almost going to guarantee that you're going to end up at a lower paying job. Then the lower paying jobs are the ones that are generally considered essential right now. Those are the frontline workers. So those that came from the lower paying school or the underfunded school, they're in those positions and they're being forced into the work field right now and don't often have that opportunity to shelter in place because they still have to go to work. And those are the people that are keeping this country going.
What makes these protests stand out compared to the ones in the past?
So I think the fact that the momentum is still going, and I personally feel like it's picking up. I don't see an end to it soon. I think people are waking up, and more of other races are speaking up as well, because it's not on Black people to put an end to racism. We are doing most of the work trying to get other people to understand, but it's really on them to do that work within themselves. We're really just trying to help them out. And also the fact that I don't think I've seen a negative picture of George Floyd, which is a first for me. I generally, when this happens, you know, they talk about he, you know, stole a Snickers from a gas station when he was 7, or he's, you know, they'll release a picture of him in high school with his middle finger up. I don't think I've seen that with him. And it has actually really shocked me. And I feel like that maybe they're learning from the things we've been saying all these years, that, you know, what does that have to do with anything? Maybe those pictures just don't exist, and that's why it hasn't happened. But it gave me a little bit of hope that they didn't put his family through that in this situation like they have almost every other person.
In Minneapolis, they have upgraded the charges on the officer that killed George Floyd, and they also brought about charges to the other officers that were involved. What is your reaction?
That's another thing that makes me feel like this is a little bit different, and maybe this is the change in pace that we need. That's not something that we see very often. And the fact that all of the officers have now been charged, that is unique. I think it gives me a little bit more hope that, you know, maybe George Floyd is the chink in the armor that, you know, that will allow us to start breaking through.
Our governor, J.B. Pritzker, has called in the National Guard troops and state police troopers to help in cities across the state. A lot of the bigger cities have instituted curfews, but at the same time, he's saying the structural change demanded by protesters around Illinois will come from nonviolent demonstrations coupled with policy reforms. Do you agree?
Well, I definitely agree that it's going to take policy reform for real change. I think the rebellions and the looting and things that we're seeing on TV and hearing about, I think a lot of that is sensational. So it gets more media attention than the peaceful events that are happening out there, but it's definitely going to take policy reform. And I'm all about the peaceful protest, but I also recognize that they say actions speak louder than words. And sometimes when people have tried their words for so long and you don't listen, they will show you with their actions, and sometimes that comes in the form of, you know, property damage when people get so fed up. We've got some meetings coming up with elected officials. We're trying to foster a relationship to work together for some real change, because the rallying and the protesting is excellent. It helps keep the momentum going. It helps keep the focus on what you're doing, but you also have to be meeting with the people who can actually bring about the change that you're asking for at that rally.
I do have a personal question. How are you doing? Are you getting any sleep? And what are you doing taking care of yourself? Because I know you're pretty busy right now.
I sleep probably, I'd say, 4 to 5 hours a night right now. And I think I've had the same headache for roughly 6 days now. I'm at the edge of, I'm getting to the point where I don't have anything left to give. But Black Lives Matter has taken a bigger lead right now because of the momentum. So it's a hard thing to balance, but I mean, you know, you just do it.
That's Sunshine Clemens with Black Lives Matter Springfield, and she spoke with our Olivia Mitchell. This week, a number of communities saw an outbreak of violence and looting. In other towns, there were lots of unfounded rumors getting posted to social media. Bill Wheelhouse talked with Al Tompkins. He's senior faculty at the Poynter Institute, a Florida-based journalism education group, about the messages showing up on Facebook and elsewhere.
Al, as I scan around, even this morning in the newspapers around the state, I saw a town over in western Illinois, 40,000 people, and a number of stores had barricaded their facilities. And it was largely, I think, based on internet rumors, Facebook. People are hearing there's going to be mobs coming to town on buses. What's going on out there in terms of this?
In some cases, police departments, for example, in Clearwater, Florida, police departments have validated that they've also heard similar kinds of rumors. But largely, these are, in fact, rumors. Some of them have been tied to a couple of white supremacy groups. There's a group called Identity Europa, another one called the American Guard. And they have been online posing as an Antifada movement and writing these kinds of missives that get a lot of people stirred up and worried. This is not unheard of. We actually saw this during the 2016 campaign when we heard stories about protesters on the way to attend Trump rallies, when, in fact, what we ended up finding out much later is that some of those were internet rumors that showed up on Facebook and actually in some cases got reported by normally responsible outlets. So you just have to keep asking yourself, you know, does this make sense? Where does this come from? What do we know about the source? And just beware that there are many, many different people looking to try to influence your thinking right now. There is a big play for the hearts and minds of the public that go way beyond what's happening in the streets of America.
So this is different than the old rumor mill. I remember as a young kid in central Illinois, and there were rumors going around our town that all these Hell's Angels were going to be coming through, going to some motorcycle races nearby. But this is more of rumors starting from a bad source in a way.
Well, there are lots of motivations for misinformation and disinformation. And by the way, they're different. Misinformation may just be, I just got it wrong, or I heard something, but I didn't get it right. Disinformation, and that's largely what this is meant to mislead you. There's an intent. There's a profit that comes from it. And the profit can be many things. It could be, in some cases, misinformation and disinformation is motivated by money. In some places, it's motivated by politics. But sometimes it's just motivated to try to cause confusion to try to get your eyes off of something else so that you'll pay attention to this, to stir up fear. And so there are lots of different motives for so many of these things. There's another way of thinking about these kinds of posts, and that's what I call propaganda. Propaganda isn't always false. It's usually just one-sided. So propaganda usually just tells you one piece of the story without putting it into context. And that one piece favors one point of view, one side, one way of thinking. Think about commercials. Mostly commercials are propaganda. Why? Because they tell you all the good things this product will do, but they don't tell you anything else that you might want to consider before you buy it. So there's a difference between misinformation, disinformation, and propaganda, and all of them have to do with motive. Ask yourself, who could be behind this information, and how might this information benefit them?
Now, you have spent a lot of time teaching reporters even on what could be false and why. What, as you observe media, I know you sample it across the country. What are you seeing in terms of how they are reporting these rumors that sometimes feel like it could be truth in the midst of a disturbance or a protest?
Mostly what I'm seeing is pretty responsible reporting, because we're a lot more savvy now than we were in the 2016 election about interference and disinformation and misinformation. Just as consumers have gotten more savvy, I hope and I think that journalists have as well, to be able to say, wait a minute, that doesn't sound right. There were photos earlier this week of President Trump holding the Bible, looking just like Adolf Hitler holding the Bible. And it turns out that, of course, the photos of Adolf Hitler holding the Bible were false. It was just a digital insert of the Bible into a hand that made it look like President Trump was emulating Adolf Hitler. So those are the kinds of things that people just don't fall for much anymore. I mean, we've been, as users of social media, we've all been burned so many times that we're just skeptical of everything. But one of the things I would say is don't get cynical. Be skeptical, but not cynical. Skeptical means, look, I'm open to truth. I'm open to finding facts. I'm open to a different point of view. But I need proof. And if you supply me with proof, I can adjust my thinking. Being cynical means I don't believe anything. And that doesn't help anybody. We have to be open to truth when it presents itself.
Is there anything else you'd like to add or clarify?
Well, one thing I would say is this, and that is before you pass anything on to somebody else, remember you're responsible for what comes out of your fingers. So just like you're responsible for whatever you tell somebody else, you're responsible for what you pass along on social media or email as well. And whether you understand it or not, you are an influencer. All of us are. All of us have some influence over somebody. Somebody is looking to us to be a source of information, whether it's our kids, our family, our friends, our church members, whatever it is. So be responsible for what you say and understand that what you say can work for good, but it also can cause great harm, in that it can be the sort of information that others cite as their principal source of information. Just be responsible. If you don't know where it came from, if you haven't done even the least amount of research, don't pass it on.
Al Tompkins is with the Poynter Institute. He spoke with Bill Wheelhouse. You're listening to Statewide. There's more ahead. Stay with us. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll hear about a father-son duo making music and lifting spirits during the pandemic. That story is on the way. Well, many businesses in Chicago were given the go-ahead to reopen this week after being closed due to COVID-19, but that path to reopening has been complicated by several nights of civil unrest. Kate McGee with member station WBEZ tells us how one black-owned business is grappling without a rebuild after it was destroyed.
4 years ago, Jasmine Clayton and her husband Michael poured their life savings into a luxury nail salon in River North called Relux. Business was booming, Clayton says.
Before COVID, Relux was the hottest nail salon in River North. A lot of the businesses in the neighborhood would frequent our salon. They would bring their clients because we offered something different.
Then COVID-19 arrived, shutting down business for 2.5 months. They weren't able to continue paying their employees that entire time and are missing vital household income. When Mayor Lori Lightfoot announced businesses like theirs could open June 3rd with specific safety measures, Clayton started preparing, reducing her staff to 4 technicians a shift and spacing apart stations.
We were also going to space each appointment 15 minutes apart so that after the clients left, we were able to go back and kind of sanitize the polished bottles, the tables, the pedicure stations.
They stocked up on extra masks for workers and clients, thermometers to check clients' temperatures, and tons of cleaning supplies. Then came the death of George Floyd, who was killed when a Minneapolis police officer put his knee on Floyd's neck. And on Saturday, like so many stores, her nail salon was hit by waves of looters, all of it caught on their security cameras.
We were able to see how the looters and or protesters were smashing things, taking polish, taking safes, taking equipment. taking lights and just destroying the entire salon.
Another group came in 30 minutes later and took what was left.
It was really hard to watch.
Clayton says she supported the protests seeking justice for Floyd, but as a Black-owned business, she feels conflicted about all of it. Now that her livelihood has been destroyed due to escalating violence.
I felt violated. I felt there was no sense of unity at all when this was done to me, you know? I was hurt. I'm devastated, honestly.
Now she says it's hard for her to tell the difference between protesters and looters.
I felt like this protest was for the upliftment of the Black community, for the upliftment of Black people. And I felt as though there should have been some sense of protection for us.
By us, she says she means small businesses that don't have the money to easily rebuild. She and her husband spent 12 hours cleaning up the damage on Sunday. Clients and neighbors stopped by to help clean up the mess, and they've pitched in financially. Clayton set up a fundraiser on Facebook that raised more than $12,000 in 24 hours. Now they've raised closer to $14,000. But Clayton says they're still so far away from reopening.
Honestly, that's just enough to pay the company that boarded up the windows and maybe replace a couple of things that we lost, maybe some equipment, but not nearly as much as we need to actually open our doors and operate, even with only 5 staff members working at a time.
Mayor Lightfoot announced partnerships with local chambers of commerce to help businesses affected by the unrest. She urged insurance agencies to move quickly to help damaged businesses. Clayton is still figuring out what insurance will cover at her salon. It breaks her heart that Relux can't open its doors. Kate McGee, WBEZ News.
Northern Illinois University President Lisa Freeman is working on a plan to reopen colleges and universities in the state, including her own campus. Chase Cavanaugh has more on what it's been like to make these decisions and what advice she has for prospective students.
Mid-March is when Dr. Freeman is engaging donors and alumni, but the situation changed quickly while she was on a cross-country flight.
For our annual Washington, D.C. alumni reception, when the governor declared the state of emergency, and fortuitously I was transferring at Midway, and I just never got on the plane to D.C., came back to campus, and started making the decisions about the spring semester.
Initially, NIU planned on switching to remote learning for just a few weeks after spring break. But it soon became clear that it would become the rest of the semester.
We had to not just adjust instructionally, but we had to figure out how to relocate the students who were remaining on campus so that we could effectively achieve physical distancing and still make sure their needs were being met.
On a wider scale, Freeman says the uncertainty surrounding coronavirus and the constant sources of new information complicate the decision-making process.
We always prioritize the health and wellness of our community and try to lead with our vision, mission, and values. But we also understand that we're going to need to continually assess the measures that we've taken and adjust when circumstances change. And that's been an ongoing process this spring.
Most faculty and staff are working remotely. Summer classes will also be remote. Many of the summer camps planned for campus have been canceled or are now being planned virtually. In April, Freeman announced a voluntary retirement program for staff and cuts to part-time positions. She also instituted what she calls a hiring chill for new positions. Freeman says she's under no illusions that people will be pleased at every decision she makes.
If I get pushback and that pushback or lack of support makes me realize that there was an unintended consequence or something that was missed in the decision-making, then we switch to that form of thinking, is there an adjustment that needs to be made?
Freeman says she's been in regular contact with the university presidents at other public institutions in state and around the country. She's part of a committee with the Illinois Board of Higher Education on planning out what reopening means for colleges and universities.
And it's not going to be a very prescriptive set of guidelines. It's going to be higher ed specific guidelines that give each of our unique institutions a foundation for making the decisions that work best on their campuses.
The committee hopes to present those recommendations to the Department of Public Health next month.
They're concerned with what they can do to maintain the health and wellness of their community and to integrate public health recommendations with needs to consider social, emotional, and economic health considerations as well. And we see the diversity of institutions in Illinois that we see nationally.
Freeman adds that maintaining social and emotional connections has also been essential for her personally during the pandemic.
Is by just always thinking about our students and the impact that a college education has on a student, their family, their community. And that keeps me going because it's so important that we continue to be there. I'm also making an effort to connect by Zoom, by phone, even by letter with family and friends.
For prospective and current students, Freeman urges against taking a gap year during the pandemic.
Don't give up on your dream. In a time of economic downturn, a college degree becomes that much more important.
And for her fellow administrators, Freeman says constant communication is key to maintaining trust with the public.
Things change so quickly. You have to be prepared to communicate what's being done today. And then next week, say we're doing things a little bit differently. And if you do that, I think you build trust. And I think it helps you moving forward.
I'm Chase Cavanaugh.
Over the last several years, Illinois has increased enrollment and improved access to preschool programs for children across the state. That's according to a recent report from the National Institute for Early Education Research. And according to that report, the state ranks number 3 in the country for access to preschool for 3-year-olds. Illinois also met most quality benchmarks outlined in the study. Education reporter Lee Gaines spoke with Stephen Barnett. He's the co-director and founder of the National Institute, and she asked him what Illinois is doing well and how that progress could be impacted by the pandemic.
Illinois has substantially expanded access to the preschool program. It's done that maintaining the level of spending, which is essential for quality, and it's a program with relatively high quality standards. And that matters a lot because it's increasingly clear that only high quality preschool programs produce the kinds of impacts in terms of better preparing kids for kindergarten and long-term gains in terms of their school and social success.
Has Illinois made this progress in a short period of time?
Illinois actually got thrown off track by the Great Recession, and the percentage of children served actually started going down, and funding dropped precipitously. So this is a big change, increasing the money per child at the same time as bringing the numbers of kids served back up.
How could the COVID-19 pandemic affect the state's early childhood education system moving forward?
From the local level on up, decisions will be driven by legal requirements for spending. I don't have enough money to go around, and some programs I am legally required to fund, and other programs I am not. Preschool is overwhelmingly a discretionary program, and if there aren't enough dollars to go around, the dollars will come out of early childhood, will come out of preschool, and go into other things regardless of how we value them. Without any decision about is this the right thing to do, it's the legally mandated thing to do. And why I'd like to see the federal government dedicate some dollars for pre-K so that there's a kind of similar constraint. I can get this money, but only if I use it to fund high quality early care and education programs. That would make a difference.
And why is maintaining and increasing enrollment and spending on early education a crucial thing for the state to do?
Well, we can start with what are the benefits of high quality pre-K? Why do we do this? We do it because we know that many children, the most disadvantaged, children of color generally, begin kindergarten a year behind their peers. And we're not successful in closing those gaps in K-12. And then you get to the current crisis, and we know that more families are having their lives disrupted. Parents are losing their jobs. Incomes are declining. that makes the situations of young children even more perilous, right? Family income matters more for young children and their development than it does for older kids. They will be more greatly impacted. As they move through the early grades, move into kindergarten, they'll be further behind. There'll be more children that are further behind. Inequality will be increased. Now is not the time to be cutting back on a critical investment in the kids who will suffer most because of the pandemic.
Stephen Barnett is co-director and founder of the National Institute for Early Education Research, and he spoke with Lee Gaines. Support for Statewide comes from AARP Illinois, providing information that can help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. As many residents have been cooped up because of COVID-19, two members of the Springfield community gathered their bagpipes to lift the city's spirits and raise money. Mike Smith watched them perform, and he brings us their story.
On a warm evening in a neighborhood near Washington Park, a father-son duo pick up their bagpipes in the middle of the doorway. 54-year-old Damon McFarland and his teenage son Aiden play for a crowd of nearly 30 people. They work with United Way of Central Illinois and the Community Foundation for the Land of Lincoln to raise money for small businesses and food banks affected by COVID-19. They call it United We Pipe. For $25, Damon and Aiden will come to your driveway or somewhere outside your house and perform classic bagpipe tunes for 15 to 20 minutes. Aiden says they've been playing bagpipes for 5 years.
My sister's Scottish danced for her whole life. And 5 years ago, we went to Scotland and Ireland for her dance troupe, and then we just sort of picked it up after that.
And when we came back, he was inspired to play the bagpipes. He couldn't drive to the lessons, so since I was driving him, I figured I may as well learn too.
Damon says bagpipes are the ideal instrument for social distancing, since you can hear the music from down the block.
One thing we're very strict about is letting the people who host know that social distancing must be followed. So if people listen from their lawn, they can hear it from like probably 10 houses up. So there's no need whatsoever to get close together, but we can still enjoy the same music from a distance.
Aiden says the first performance was just for a small gathering of family and friends to celebrate a birthday around St. Patrick's Day, when social distancing requirements led to canceled celebrations and kept many from gathering.
So I just thought, why not go on my porch and just play? And like a bunch of neighbors stood out of their houses because everyone could hear it. And it was just super rewarding. So we rolled with it and thought we could end up raising money with it.
They set up an open bagpipe case where folks in the neighborhood could donate during the performance. During their first social distant concert, they raised over $300. The duo performs classic bagpiping pieces like Amazing Grace and Scotland the Brave, and adds some more contemporary songs too. With certain songs, the fingering can require a lot of speed, a skill Aiden brings to the table when playing a cover of AC/DC's Thunderstruck. Erin Weller hosted the duo's second performance in honor of her mother, who passed away 2 years ago. When her husband heard about Aiden and Damon, she says he didn't hesitate to book them for Mother's Day weekend.
Danny Boy was one song that Aiden and Damon played for me. And that drew a few tears. I don't know if you noticed, I kind of cried through the whole thing, but in a good way.
Neighbors and walkers near Washington Park started filling the streets and sidewalks to watch the performance. Weller says her mother was born and raised in Coleraine, a town in Northern Ireland. She says her Irish culture was everything to her mother, and she would have loved the bagpipe performance in her honor.
I could just my mother, wherever it is she is, looking down on me and what we were doing and what Damon and Aiden did for me, and enjoying every moment of it.
So far, the duo has performed 10 concerts and are booked for 13 more through June. They've raised over $2,700. I'm Mike Smith.
Thanks for tuning in to Statewide. We still have more to come. We'll be talking with members of the Illinois Legislature's Black Caucus about changes they say need to happen. That's still ahead. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Well, bars in Illinois can now offer curbside liquor sales. Governor J.B. Pritzker signed that measure into law this week. Bill Wheelhouse has this report.
The law is designed to spur business at bars and restaurants across the state that have suffered due to stay-at-home orders during the coronavirus outbreak. While there has been some loosening of the restrictions in recent days, this will allow patrons to buy cocktails from the car. Think getting margaritas with Mexican food. The law requires the mixed drinks to be sold in sealed containers. Supporters say the cocktails to go law will help the hospitality industry get back on its feet. The law allows the mixed drink sales for 1 year. The new law also gives an extension for renewing liquor licenses. I'm Bill Wheelhouse.
Members of the Illinois Legislative Black Caucus gathered this week to decry the looting and rioting that came while peaceful protesters marched for justice over the killing of George Floyd by a white police officer. And the lawmakers called for changing policies that feed systemic racism in Illinois. Our reporter Maureen McKinney spoke to Democratic Representatives Will Davis of South Suburban Hazelcrest and Sonia Harper, whose Southside Chicago district suffered a lot of damage.
It's just everywhere, every block you turn. There's a new building where a store was that has been not just ravaged, but all burnt out too. And it's almost saddening, like literally the restaurant we went to yesterday is burnt out today. As I drive through the streets, my baby, she just, her mouth is in, her hand is over her mouth like, Mommy. And so like, that's what we're seeing right now. We're kind of seeing the devastation from those nights of looting that took over our community.
What do you think about the rioting and looting behavior? Do you think that is partially from anger out of the George Floyd situation?
Yes, I think it's from the anger and frustration of that situation, but also of the life that everyone has lived who may have also experienced the same thing and the conditions that persist, you know, in our communities over long, you know, periods of time that allow for such incidents as this to happen again and again and again. I think that what you see is an outcry from people. I think you compound that on top of the fact that we've all been extra little stressed these past couple of months due to social distancing and staying at home.
Right.
And even with that, the added increase of losing jobs, losing the ability for your kids to go to school and having to take on those responsibilities yourself, not maybe knowing where your next meal is coming from, because maybe the place where you used to go every day, you were guaranteed a meal. It's like compounding all of those things on top of an already vulnerable situation. These communities that we live in are already vulnerable, are already on the edge.
I'm curious about what you want to see happen. What needs to happen to not let this happen in the future, both the George Floyd brutality and the destroying of your communities?
I think for me, let's go back to what precipitated this. Not that there wasn't already a tension in the air, not that there already wasn't kind of the back and forth, you know, the butting of heads, if I can say it that, not that that wasn't already there. But what really prompted all of this was the senseless killing of a Black man. And I think you have to examine what started this as part of the solution to fix it and end it. So again, we saw a man who was in custody, handcuffs, but yet the officer still felt the need to put his knee on the neck of the gentleman. The question is why? I mean, he was in handcuffs on his belly. It was unnecessary. So if we're not going back and examining that as part of this, then we're missing the point, because that means the next officer will do something like that as well. I even heard that there was a report, maybe even a video, of someone being taken into custody, and where that officer had someone handcuffed on their belly, but put his knee in the back of the individual. And then the officer, another officer noticed it and said, hey, don't do that. To me, that's the beginning of this conversation. We can talk about what ensued afterwards, the destruction, the rioting as part of the negative aftermath. Peaceful protests take place all the time. People do that as a part of showing their outrage and their concern about an issue that's going on. So that's nothing new. But when you have the kind of the negative side of it and all of the destruction that happened in the community, yeah, you can say that should have never happened. But again, before we even say that should have never happened, George Floyd should have never died.
As Representative Harper was saying, cases like this that are happening over and over again, this was like a pot boiling over. Do you feel yes. that way too?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The pot was already boiling, was already there. So it's right at the edge. And then it just needed an incident. And this was the incident that turned up the heat and boiled over and spilled, you know, out onto the streets.
Has your district been hit with rioting, looting?
Absolutely. Harvey is already a town that's struggling. Very little development, very little business opportunity. Just got a new administration in that's working hard to see how we can turn the tide on the systemic challenges that the city of Harvey have had. And yet even there, a few longstanding stores that were in Harvey did experience rioting, looting, and destruction as well over the weekend. So, and the question is always whether or not those entities will want to even rebuild.
Tell me what you want to see happen to address the situation. And my research has told me that we in Illinois and Chicago have a problem with systemic racism.
There are different issues that we've been working on, even probably in different levels of government, that we just can't seem to get the right amount of support or really giving relief to some of our communities. And that maybe when racism has been baked into policies, we now have a hard time getting them out of. I think those are the types of decisions that we need to be more careful about making. When it comes to, I think, the issue of police violence, right? I personally believe there are some police reform measures that we have put on the table time and time again that have been watered down or either may have not been implemented properly. Maybe this is a time for us to revisit some of that legislation and really show how serious we are about changing the way our police interact with community. There has just been a tremendous breakdown and from what I see, a lack of political will from any other caucus other than the Black caucus to really sit down and stop these disparities and stop these things from happening. The same reason why we have looting, the same reason why, you know, our communities are dying at faster rates from COVID-19, the same reason why we are suffering from high rates of gun violence every year.
So let me ask specifically, what legislation is really, really important that's been let to die?
A member of the Black Caucus introduced back in 2016 a bill regarding a pathway to end racial profiling, if you will, or ways to address racial profiling. So I say that to say what we see happen sometime is obviously we introduce bills and they go through a process. And sometimes bills don't move forward because not so much of the subject matter in and of itself, but the way it plays out in the districts of other individuals. So one thing that I've learned in my tenure is that self-interest rules the day and trying to keep the majority rules the day. So if you've got a bill that comes across or is interpreted as being soft on crime, then you'll find that for some members, even on our side of the aisle, Sonya and I are both Democrats, that we can't get support from some areas, from some members, because they feel that in their districts, that appears to be soft on crime. And in my district, I can't appear to be soft on crime. And that's not, that characterization is to me more of a cop out than anything, because I remember a bill a few years back to allow for a tax credit to businesses who hired ex-offenders. I don't see if an ex-offender, somebody who has served their debt to society, is now out and looking for an opportunity, something that would encourage a business owner to hire them and offer an incentive to the business owner. I don't know how that's soft on crime. And, Democrats in certain areas couldn't vote for it, is that that was the characterization of the bill, even though that was completely false. So there's an internal fight even that we have with trying to get bills passed, because that member now has to evaluate how their district will view that effort and whether or not that could be a challenge to them when they run for reelection. I think it's just the broader conversation about how we can move those issues forward, understanding the dynamics that we face with our members in the general assembly.
We have a lot of criminal justice reform efforts that are on the board right now. Our list is not complete. And however, he did outline some legislation that we were actually supposed to work on getting past this legislative session at COVID-19 happened. And so now, in light of what we are seeing now and the new and pushed call for more criminal justice reform, especially as it relates to police force, those items are now back up on the table in a major way. And we do have a committee inside of the Legislative Black Caucus that is now working on formulating some of that language right now to introduce.
Issues like Sonia mentioned with regard to criminal justice reform in particular, and there's been a lot of work on criminal justice reform. Some things have passed, some are yet to be passed, but then implementation is sometimes what's the problem. I remember years ago, we passed a bill that required police officers to fill out a contact card when they did a traffic stop. You had to collect certain information, and part of that included race. And you had police departments just say, we're not going to do it. It's in statute, it's law, but they can arbitrarily refuse. But if somebody commits a crime, does a police department say, we're not gonna arrest that individual, we'll just let them go? No, they arrest them, and then that individual is now subject to the criminal justice system. And we know some of the challenges there. So implementation is the next thing. And that's, again, without regard to any particular piece of legislation, but if it's passed, if it's in statute, if the money is being placed and the money is ready to go, you gotta have the people implementing. But being able to go back and say, well, you know what, if you don't want to implement it, police department, then fine, let's figure out how to impact your funding. Then it becomes a broader conversation, and nobody wants to do that. No, we don't want to take away funding from a police department because they failed to follow the law.
For either of you, what do you think should be done to address the looting and how to rebuild from it?
It happened. It was a moment in time, and maybe we're past the looting standpoint, and now we have to deal with the aftermath. And I think we can deal with the aftermath, but it has to be a very concerted effort, making sure that if they had insurance, that the insurance responds appropriately, and that there's no clause in their insurance policy that says, except for this, you know, we won't pay the claim. You know, there's some things that a business owner can't control. We require them to have insurance, but then insurance fails to help them in their time of need. So now we need to be looking at this. We just passed the capital bill. Let's figure out how to redirect, you know, a significant portion of that money for those businesses that were destroyed and damaged during this particular time.
When we're talking about like redirecting those dollars, making sure that they're going to places, you know, similar to the West and South Side and South Suburbs, where now people's real impact and quality of life have been threatened, and they're waking up with no place to go buy groceries, no place to go buy their pharmacy prescriptions, so forth and so on. And so I guess what I'm saying is we want to make sure it gets redirected to the places that it's most in need, and make sure that it's done in a timely manner.
Representative Sonia Harper represents part of the south side of Chicago, and Will Davis of South Suburban Hazelcrest. They spoke with Maureen McKinney. Thanks for being with us for this episode of Statewide. If you missed any part of this week's program or past shows, you can find them all at statewideshow.com. Our podcast is available through the NPR One app. Support for Statewide comes from AARP Illinois, providing information that can help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. We'll be back next week with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.